It is brought to you today by your cable or satellite provider.
Up next on Book TV's Afterwards program, journalist Cheryl Atkison reports on how smear tactics are used to influence public opinion in her book, The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. She's interviewed by Eric Wemple, Washington Post media critic.
You've had something of a remarkable media career, one that I have covered. I cover the media for the Washington Post, and I've covered somewhat extensively throughout the years. Why don't you give us some words about where you've been and where you are now, and how it relates to The Smear and your previous book, Stonewalled, which had some interesting material in it as well. Why don't you just give us a rundown of where you've been and
years in local news, and then CNN for 3 years, and then CBS New York, you know, national, but based in New York. I also worked for PBS for 5 or 6 years simultaneously while at CBS. Was at CBS for over 20 years and saw and talked to my colleagues who saw at news organizations a fairly dramatic shift in the past few years toward control of narratives on the news by...
And that's Stonewalled, right, basically?
That's the why I left Stonewalled, but I continue this with the smear,
right,
how these operatives or smear operators, if you want to call them that, influence, kind of get their nose under the tent at news organizations and how they influence virtually all the images that cross our paths.
Right. And over the years, you've compiled quite a list of anecdotes about your life in corporate television news, and in The Smear, one of the things that I chuckled about was you were writing about a situation in 1998, I believe, and you talk about CBS News. I believe the White House team got a tip, or got maybe it was something a little more sinister. Maybe it was a trial balloon or something that you, as you phrase it in the book. Take it from there. What happened with CBS News, and how is it is it a tale for journalists? Like, be careful.
I think so. I mean, I think legitimate leaks or legitimate information can be had by newsmakers, and we shouldn't turn up our nose at them, but you always have to be careful about what you report and how you check it out before you report it. The anecdote you're talking about was during the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky affair, and at one point, the White House, this is the story as was told in the newsroom by our White House folks at the time, the White House wanted to get out a narrative. We didn't yet know the full story about Monica Lewinsky, but they were going to float this idea that the president did kiss Monica Lewinsky, but that was all. It was just a kiss. And they kind of wanted to see if that would do enough to maybe please the public, because admit to something, but say that it wasn't more. So we reported that on the news based on an anonymous source. We couldn't say who it was. And immediately afterwards, I think the White House was sorry that they floated it.
The reaction wasn't what they wanted.
Must not have been, because then publicly they started denying that that was the case without admitting that they were the ones that had planted the story.
And they could do that perfectly plausibly because an anonymous source had been...
Right. And because I remember saying to our White House people when they felt sold down the river because their story was called false by the same people who planted it, if that
makes
sense.
The very same people.
Well, I don't know if I down to the identity, maybe not, but I think they were well aware
of it.
Yes. And I said, why don't you just tell what happened? And they said, well, we have to protect our source. I said, but that's not a real source if they planted something incorrect or false
with
you.
They should burn the source in that instance.
I think you have, you know, grounds to do that.
If the source lies, is that a lie? Well, Rahm Emanuel came and said that it was never even under consideration is what you point out in there. And I was like, wow. You know, I cover the media and get, you know, leaks of this sort all the time. And, you know, we're thinking of this or, you know, this is off the record, blah, blah, blah. And we're constantly being asked to put our own integrity and reputation behind the thoughts and the preferences of other people. And so it struck me as an interesting anecdote. Of course, in Stonewalled, the point that you were making was, and there were some dramatic moments that you recount in there where you're talking with either bureau chief or someone way up, and you say that certain corporations were off limits to you as a reporter, because you've done a lot of reporting on corporate malfeasance and misfeasance and so on and so forth. And so you left CBS, and now you're at Sinclair Broadcast. You do Full Measure, which is distributed throughout the country on the Sinclair stations. Do you encounter any of that sort of control or
not
stipulation?
Yet? And not that yet. Was, you know, when I left CBS, I didn't think I would necessarily work in the business at all ever again, because I didn't really see a place based on my friends and contacts that I could go and do the kind of reporting I expected to be able to do that they would want.
Right.
And that I would be unfettered. So this opportunity came up out of the blue. They created the program with the promise
it's
of the editorial
Sunday morning,
freedom.
9:30, right? Or
right.
Depending
on
the market.
Yes.
Right.
And so far, no editorial interference. I run my stories through a normal editorial process of lawyers and an ethics review like I did at CBS, which was voluntary, by the way, at CBS. They didn't require it, but I did it. Here we have a similar process, but there has been no editorial interference trying to shape my stories. Nothing like, you know, at CBS at the end, they told you what they wanted your interviewees to say and what the facts ought to show, you know, before you even gathered them.
Right, and you bolted. There was some reporting, I believe, sometime last year or maybe in the transition that Jared Kushner had said to some New York executives that Sinclair had made some sort of access for coverage deal. Did you know anything about that? Do you believe that's true? And have you taken that up with any of the higher-ups in management?
No, I didn't know anything about it.
Uh-huh.
I know from what I read, I think, I can't name the publication because I may get it wrong, retracted what they had reported because it turned out that they had misinterpreted it, kind of picked up someone else's reporting and misinterpreted. They apologized for it. There was a misunderstanding, I guess, of emails. I know that our show, we offered opportunities for Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, in fact, to do interviews constantly.
Right, you mentioned
constantly.
That you tried to get Clinton like
34. Well, Clinton, you know, she kept acting like she might do it. I mean, there was a constant dialogue going on. If maybe, how about this city, how about that city? So we never did get an interview with her, but we offered all of them opportunities, including some of the other candidates I didn't just name who were still candidates at the time. So our program offered, you know, full access anytime, any place to all of them.
And you, Full Measure goes out to how many stations? So
it's broadcast to 43 million households.
Okay.
I think it's 100 and maybe 150 stations, something like that.
And so that's not a bad pitch when you approach Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or any other major politician, that you have this sort of line to middle America in perhaps a way that other stations don't. Is that the...
I don't make the pitch personally, but yes, I've seen that, from example, when we go to members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, sometimes they'll say, oh, you know, you have a station, you have two stations in my market, and they do want to be seen and heard. They like that idea of being seen and heard on that show.
Getting to the smear, you know, one of the things I looked at when I was reading the book and researching a little bit is the Google mentions of the smear.
Mm-hmm.
They spike, the term smear, they spike in the 30s and they go way up in the post-war era, and they're pretty high now, but tailed off a little bit after 2000, according to this graph. I know you get into the history of the smear a little bit in your book. Why 2017? Are smear tactics, worse than ever? Are they about the same as where they were for your entire career, or where are they?
I think they've grown more sophisticated and broader, and that's why I thought of the book actually a couple years ago, not knowing we would end up here in 2017 necessarily, but knowing we were headed in that general direction, largely because of the internet, you know, the proliferation of social media and the internet tools that make opportunities for smear artists, as they talk about in the book themselves. And also because there's just more opportunities to get narratives out. There's organized activities and organized industry in Washington, D.C. that have studied this. They've studied what works and what doesn't work. And I think it all came into play like never before in 2016. I started the book before the 2016 campaign.
Right, but and I you think, ran right into it.
Yeah, I think that just everything dovetailed right into 2016, as you see.
Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I want to sort of focus in on, with the way you define smear in the book is you say one man's smear is another man's truth. In simple terms, it's an effort to manipulate opinion by promulgating an overblown, scandalous, and damaging narrative. So That is a little bit different from the dictionary definition, which seems to, most of the dictionary definitions I looked at, seem to require that a smear is something that's false. But you in the book and in the definition appear to comprehend a greater community of allegations and so on and so forth. Talk a little bit about why your approach is a little more inclusive, if indeed you believe it is.
I think you're right about that. It's because the smears that I look at and consider smears, some of the best ones, are rooted in a little bit of truth. And I describe it how a smear operator lays in wait and waits for a small mistake against a target and can amplify that into a giant misdeed that reverberates in the national consciousness. And I think what differentiates a smear from a criticism that's born of something more legitimate, that's a moral outrage, is that the smear's purpose is rooted in annihilation or destruction of the target, not in just bringing something to light and maybe garnering an apology, but in destroying the target or the idea, and that there is often a not always disclosed financial or political motive behind the smear.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the smear operators, you will find, as I point out in the book, overlook the same sort of behavior in their allies that they mm-hmm. attack their targets mm-hmm. for, and I think that's another hallmark of a smear and how smear artists operate. Mm-hmm.
So you go into a lot of detail on a lot of them in here. What's your favorite example in the book? If I have to ask you to bring forth one example from the book, which would you cite?
Gee, superlatives are tough for me because I really would like to think about them.
I can start if you want. I think it's one of the first ones, which gets straight at the sort of the tension that I was discussing, is the Imus thing. So Don Imus, I guess is what year, 2007, is on the radio and talking about a women's college basketball game, and he refers to the Rutgers players, right, as mm-hmm. nappy-headed hoes mm-hmm. or something like that. And you frame this up, or in your telling, it is an example of a David Brock, the longtime once conservative propagandist, moves to liberal propagandist, who gets a lot of ink in the smear. We'll get into that a little bit more later. But what makes what they did with Imus a smear campaign?
Well, first of all, the playbook for that, right, which was well publicized because Brock talked about it afterwards and Media Matters talked about it, was a playbook for future operations to come. Right. So I thought that was instructive. But second of all, it was sort of quintessential in that Imus really did say that. That really was a bad thing.
Right.
That was rooted in truth. But what they wanted out of that was annihilation. They wanted him off the air. They didn't want an apology. They weren't just, in my view, taking moral high ground and trying to draw attention to that. They wanted him gone. And the reasons were, in my opinion, rooted more in the donors and the interest that backed David Brock, and who Imus did or didn't support politically, more so than anything else, more so than just this was an outrage that they thought had to be corrected. So I thought that was a good example of that sort of an operation.
But the thing is that it didn't come out of nowhere, right? Imus had a tremendous history of really nasty, bigoted statements
on
air.
And that's my point. And had
what
not.
Here's the thing. Go ahead. That's your point. I'll let you finish.
The point is, as I say in the book, that's what Imus does. And you can see that his past comments had not drawn that sort of outrage and ire till a point came in which he was targeted by Media Matters. And then they took something he said, which was no more or less objectionable probably than many other things he'd said in the past, and were able to...
We could differ on that, but...
Well, he said a lot of objectionable... I can't cite them off the top of my head, but he had said a lot of objectionable things according to his critics in the past. And this is something that they were able to create a campaign around by amplifying what happened, using their website, using their social media tools, and using their network of news organizations. So that was different.
Right. Let me just move into that question of amplification a little more. You are on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. you at CBS News and at Sinclair at Full Measure, you amplify every day, right? You, if an administration official says something, it may not be much noticed. Find tape of people saying things, may not be much noticed. What is the problem? And it seems as though you're calling this a problem. You're calling this an evil. What is the evil in amplification? You understand what I'm saying? I mean, it's part of an open society, right? We have platforms set up to amplify things. And so Don Imus, and I think you did point this out, you pointed out that in the beginning, very few actually noticed this. And that's a common thing with these situations. I'll bring up another case in point. Last October, Jesse Waters on Fox News did a segment on Chinatown, and it was widely viewed, and I agree, as being offensive towards Asian Americans or Asians just in general. It trafficked in a lot of terrible stereotypes. It was just schlock. Now, O'Reilly gets on the television and talks with Chris Wallace of Fox News about this, and he says that, well, you know, nobody made much of a fuss about it the first night. It wasn't until people got a hold of it. Isn't that a good thing that things are amplified, that, you know, that people say, hey, look at this, you may have missed this? Because neither you nor I nor anyone else can see all of CNN, all of MSNBC, all of Fox, all of radio. I mean, radio, come on, it's as sprawling as you, podcasts, so on and so forth. So isn't there good in amplification?
Well, you asked a long question there.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I don't think I use the word evil in the book. I'm not sure. And I'm careful to say some people may very well agree with what's done. And I'm not here to tell you that everything a smear operator or a propagandist does is evil or bad. I'm drawing attention more so to how they operate and how at times they're able to operate in such a way that presents a distorted or over-exaggerated picture of something that happened in a way that's intended to make people think there's overwhelming support for or against something, when maybe there's not. You should at least ask the question. When maybe it's a handful of similar people operating under different names with different groups and sometimes even fake social media accounts, that then does take on often a grassroots part, and that you could argue, depending on where you sit, is a good thing. So I'm kind of dissecting the way smear artists operate, the tools they use. Sometimes you might say the results are good. Sometimes you might say the results are bad or evil. I think it just depends on where you sit and what the particular case is.
Clearly, in the case of Imus, you thought that he was a victim of a smear campaign.
He's a victim of a smear campaign, but I don't argue that what he said was right or that what he said wasn't wrong or shouldn't have been discussed. It's just a really good dissection of a quintessential operation.
But once again, this is the Atkinson definition of smear and not the dictionary, because there was nothing false in this campaign. Was there? Was there anything false in the campaign?
I didn't look at everything that was put out to see what was true and what was false, but I don't allege that what was put out was false. And I even have Imus quoted in there as he kind of said, I deserved it, you know, in the end.
Right.
Fairly recently, he said to me, I said what I said, as I point out in the book.
Is there a problem here? Is it problematic?
I don't think I present the Imus case as a problem. It's more of a case study that shows how subsequent smears were devised and how they learn from each other, the different operators on both sides of the political spectrum and even corporate actors. They watch this. They see what tools work, how advertising can be used, how partners in nonprofits, how social media can be used. That's an instructive dissection of what I call a smear.
Okay. It's a sort of, you say, Media Matters has managed to place a barely noticed remark on the dashboards of millions of Americans and escalate it into a national outrage. That sounds like a scold, right? More than this case study.
If you want to call it that.
Let me read it again.
That's a factual statement.
Well, I'm not saying it's factual.
It's not factual.
Right. Yeah. I'm not saying it's not factual. I'm just saying that sounds like a remark of considerable disapproval on your part.
That's meant to be read, and you can take it however you like.
Okay, well, I just want to read it again and see if you get this.
Read it five times if you want, Eric.
Media Matters has managed to place a barely noticed remark on the dashboard of millions of Americans and escalate it into a national outrage.
Right, exactly. That's the best thing a smear artist can do. If they can take something other people wouldn't have seen, use the tools they have at their disposal against a target, you know, that they've been monitoring, and generate it into something that even generates national news coverage in legitimate news organizations. That's a huge success story.
Using 100% true evidence to do so.
Right.
Okay. Glenn Beck. Let's plow through some of the specifics with Glenn Beck. You state that, is that a similar sort of thing where he was not being very well heated, or there was not a lot of attention paid to him, and then he did get slammed by Media Matters. He did get pushed out of Fox.
I think more attention at the time was being paid to him probably than the remark we discussed with Imus.
Right.
I think Beck was getting a huge following, and that was part of why he was so disturbing to the people that he opposes or that oppose him. And they went after him precisely because he had a large platform at Fox. His show was becoming very successful. And then day after day, the drumbeat that he was following was his own smear campaign, you could say, against Media Matters types and George Soros. And they were monitoring him. So it was sort of this dueling campaign between the two of them. But they made, as you'll see in the book, a very public announcement, $1 million from George Soros, kind of specifically to get Glenn Beck as a danger to humanity and society.
Right.
And I think they claim credit for pulling him off
yes,
the air, and
do.
I think they were.
Yes, they do. And so you're not making any value judgment whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
No, I'm not. I think it's just a good instructional tool of how an effective smear operation or smear campaign was conducted.
But smear is not a positive thing, right? Smear
right.
is a use of a false accusation to degrade someone's reputation. A synonym for smear is slander, libel, sully, all those words. So if you're saying you're not casting any judgment on it, and the title of the book is smear, how do you reconcile those two things?
Because you're trying to define a word. I've been clear how I define it and discuss it off the front of the book. You can talk about the dictionary all you want. It's clear in the book what I'm talking about in terms of what I consider. But the smear, no, it is a negative thing. They weren't spreading good things about Glenn Beck. They were spreading negative things about Glenn Beck, and they were getting advertisers and spreading the word far and wide to try to have his show removed, which they did. So in both of those cases, and I think those were two of the best and earliest examples of Media Matters kind of honing its strategy and how they could target somebody that opposed ideologically with their donors or who their interests were, and they could actually affect a huge change that in the past might have gone kind of unnoticed, especially without the use of the social media tools and the network they had developed within newsrooms and their online listservs and so on.
But if it's true, can it be a smear campaign?
Well, obviously in the book, the cases that I've outlined, some of them, as I say, are rooted in truth, or at least a grain of truth, even ones that veer off into untrue information. Often the best or most effective ones have at their root at least some truth to them.
Well, with Beck, I mean, he said the president was racist, and had a deep, President Obama, that is, had a deep-seated hatred for white people. He talked a lot about apocalypse on his show. He had some really out there sort of things that he was saying. I guess the question is that a smear campaign if you're just repeating Glenn Beck's words?
This is how I define it.
Right.
If you disagree, that's fine. You're free to disagree. I define it as if your purpose is rooted in not just moral high ground, as you may present it, but in annihilation of a target and someone who's been targeted for a political or perhaps financial interest that isn't always disclosed. I think, yeah, that qualifies, at least in terms of my discussion, as a smear campaign. And that's often pointed to by the smear operators that I interviewed as successful cases, both Imus and Glenn Beck. I didn't often pull these sort of out of a hat. I asked the people I interviewed what they looked at and what they saw in their industry as successful and what they looked for. And Glenn Beck and Imus were too oft-cited.
To offsite. Okay. Yes. No, I understand that. And, you know, moving on, you mentioned you go into the 2016 campaign and you talk about Trump. And Donald Trump, of course, is someone you could devote a lot of ink to on many different levels. But obviously, in terms of the campaign, in terms of the forces that were working for Hillary Clinton, you spent a lot of time, and some of it very elucidating, on David Brock and his empire. By the way, you mentioned that you can't get certain answers to certain questions. I've asked a spokesperson for Brock as to why they wouldn't answer your questions. I haven't gotten a good answer to that question. I do not like to see people stonewall. David Brock, go into a little bit of his history. How you feel he fits, and going up into the 2016 election, and how you see him as part of the smear constellation.
Both Democrats and Republicans, I would say he was the most often cited name mm-hmm. when you talk about smears or the smear industry in Washington, however you define it. And he's fascinating in terms of a character for having started as a conservative smear artist of liberals, who smeared President Clinton, who later admitted to having done, David Brock did, unethical and questionable and dishonest things to smear the Clintons, and then practically overnight, not technically overnight, switched sides and became a right. smear artist on behalf of liberals and was invited into the Clinton fold, from which he's sat ever since, working on the other side of the fence. So he has managed to build what I call an empire that is, as I say in the book, quoted or looked at with both awe and disgust by his admirers and his detractors, and sometimes even his supporters, who are kind of a little eked out by him, but also think, boy, what he's done is pretty incredible. He's got a network of nonprofits, LLCs, websites, super PACs, that sometimes operate under neutral-sounding names, that don't always disclose their financial and political interests, as they are quoted by news organizations as they put out material under many different names, but it's sometimes just a relative handful of the same interests trying to get a message out.
Okay. And so you have him, and you've done some admirable work looking through filings and so on and so forth to determine, I think, $3.8 million in earnings, and his Mary Pat Bonner, who's the chief fundraiser, is up there around $15 million, according to your calculations. Is that...
You're probably right. I'd have to look in the book to double check. I'm not confirming those figures.
That's what I remember.
Yeah, okay.
That's
probably right.
I'll stand by them.
Okay.
but tell me a little bit. So your point there is that this. I mean, it was hard to keep track of all these appendages. You know, the Correct the Record, American Bridge, and then Correct the Facts. I don't know. 9 million different organizations. Actually, there are like 15, maybe. I don't know. But what about that, the proliferation of organizations? Does that help them? What does it do for a political operative?
You know, more had been written on, if you look at some of the conservative operators like the Koch brothers. I was able to find, I didn't write extensively about them. That's been out there, done, charted, and graphed.
Right.
Less so on all the Brock groups. There had been a little bit done, but nothing as extensive as I have done. And it looks to me like he has multiple organizations that all have the same basic purpose. Many of them say, if you look at their mission on their tax forms and so on, that they train pundits to fan out and go on the news and to appear to distribute talking points and messaging. But many of them do the same thing over and over. They collect money in ways that whether intentional or not, in ways that cannot be traced right. to a specific donor. So, and then it moves around between the David Brock groups in right. ways that make it difficult to trace whether that's intentional or not. So I think it's a way to, again, in my view, make it look as though a message is coming from many different people, different groups that the public doesn't know and reporters maybe don't bother to find out.
It's one office.
mm-hmm. It's one office. So, you know, I think I have a list in the book of how many of these different sounding groups operate out of the same building or right. have operated out of the right. same building that David Brock operates Media Matters in. One of the funnier moments was when Media Matters, I think it was Media Matters for America, one of their offshoots right. got in some trouble over a controversy.
It was the C4 and the C3, right?
Well, yes, and David Brock said he blamed one on, he said, That's not our fault. That's the other arm's fault.
I think it was
fault.
Media Matters blaming the...
Messaging Matters or something
right.
like that.
I got a statement. I wrote. I remember writing about that. They
blamed each other when, right. in fact, he's head of both. They're in the same offices. They share personnel. But he tried to make it look as though, in my view, they were two different organizations, and one had done something rogue, and he was horrified by it. And so that lends credence to the idea in my mind that he at least would like it to look as though there are all these different organizations with different people that are disconnected, but all sort of representing, you know, mm-hmm. various groups.
And Media Matters is, you view them as auteurs of smears over and over again to get this stuff done. Obviously, Media Matters has a counterpart in the conservative world, which is Newsbusters and the Media Research Center. They do a lot of amplification, too. Like, they'll watch Andrea Mitchell and say she's done this or done that. Do you see any difference in terms of qualitatively in how they roll?
I talk a little bit about that. I think that the biggest difference is Media Matters has been much more successful. I think they've been more pervasive. I think they've, by their own account and also by the people who would like to be like them, conservative interests, they've just managed to play the game a lot better. I think both political sides want to achieve the same goals and have tried. And with limited success, as I outline in the book, sometimes conservatives feel they had the upper hand at this game over time. Sometimes liberals felt like they had the upper hand in the game. Currently, as I state here, pretty much everybody thought going into 2016 that the liberals had the upper hand in terms of messaging. Then you see how the election turned out, and you have to question whether all this money spent by these groups to put out certain narratives, especially political narratives, was that money down the drain? It kind of proved that these networks and these talking points that were so pervasive in the end didn't have the desired effect. So that right. was an interesting outcome.
What exactly did Brock and his people and his organizations do in the 2016 election that you define as a smear?
They perpetuated a lot of articles and coverage, and they hired people they called reporters that they would pay to write stories with certain viewpoints, and then they would publish some of them themselves on David Brock's own websites. Some of them they had placed, they work with partners in the quasi-news world, and they could get these stories placed so that they look to the casual observer as if they are sort of organic efforts that are out there. So that's one thing he did. But day in and day out, Media Matters is very ubiquitous in its handling of information on its website, its distribution of talking points to reporters. And his super PAC bragged of all of the people that it had influenced and the stories that it had generated and how damaging it had been for certain candidates like Jeb Bush, that they had been responsible, they claimed credit for anyway, for establishing narratives on Republican candidates, negative narratives, before they could even get out of the gate.
Okay. With respect to Trump, I know that the Washington Post sort of figures in there a little bit because of the Access Hollywood tape. This is October 7th, of course. A really big moment when the tape comes of Trump saying to Billy Bush all these nasty things, like grab him by the pussy and all this real...
Beep,
right? Real terrible stuff. And you say that that is, if I'm not mistaken, you say that that's the mother of all smears. How is that a smear?
Was it that, or was it the... there were two that I highlighted, including the New York Times article about all the women he had mistreated, that... The women came out afterwards and said they were misquoted, mischaracterized in the article. So maybe also this was grouped under that heading,
right.
or I've, you know. Because, again, that was an amplified incident, the same sort of behavior that...
What was amplified about the tape? I mean, that was just, the tape was played. Right?
I just mean amplified. It was really broadly circulated and sent around in you know, hyperspeed fashion by all the people that oppose the president's candidate's interests. And
so another true smear.
Yeah, I mean it was rooted in truth. Obviously, I don't think anybody took even the president didn't seem to take issue with with the words that he spoke.
Right.
The way it was characterized, the way it was spread, and the way it was used, I mean, people didn't just report that this happened. It took on this life of its own, as you saw in the news, with people demanding all kinds of things happen, and that it was the worst thing that had ever, you know, happened on the planet, and that he must not be a candidate.
Wasn't it pretty awful, though? I mean, wasn't it just objectively horrific?
It was very negative. I don't think anybody is arguing the opposite. I don't think anybody ever argued the opposite. And I'm not saying certainly that it shouldn't have been reported. But the tone and tenor that it took and the amount of airspace that it sucked up on the national news, when there are so many things that, you know, need to be reported, smacked of a narrative being promulgated. Not that it was a false narrative, but that it was an amplified narrative beyond what I think it probably deserved in terms of a pure news sense. I talk about some smears.
But you have.
I talk about some smears in the past that have happened, and then I compared other things in the world that were happening that were not covered. It shows you the amount of attention something was getting because there was an interest that was interested in annihilation of the target versus legitimate news events as well that were happening internationally that got almost no coverage. And I think sometimes these, what I call
what
smears...
What were the things happening internationally?
Well, I'd have to look back at the book. I hate to cite off the top of my head, but there were important stories on another smear that I did compare this to the headlines that didn't make the news as much as a smear headline, and important international events about huge civil rights violations in foreign countries in which the United States was involved, giant rape cases at a university that, you know, had to be thrown out because something was wrong with the case. There were many big stories that when these narratives effectively overtake the news that are crowded out, and they serve to sort of take up all the airspace where nothing else fits in, and I think that's part of the harm that they do.
But this wasn't a narrative, this was a story.
It becomes a narrative, in my view, when it's not just a story that's told with what I would consider, after having been in the business for all the decades I did, was sort of the normal emphasis on the story that it deserves and the coverage. When something takes a grip of pretty much the whole news environment for as long as it did, I quote one guy in there that... just an average guy that I run into from time to time, and he said to me,
"That was at the fast
every time
food
I turn on the tape, every time yeah. I turn on the TV, they're talking about the tapes, days later, and you know that doesn't happen with much bigger stories at times. So you have to decide, well, why does it happen with certain stories, and then much bigger and more important stories that affect millions of Americans are never seen. And but I think that has to do with, to some degree, with the people directing or who want to promulgate a certain narrative.
But the Republican nominee being an avowed and self-professed predator toward women, does that not affect millions of Americans?
I'm not sure your characterization is exactly how I would characterize it.
But
I'm not defending the behavior, but I'm saying it probably deserves some coverage and probably deserves significant coverage. I'm not arguing that. But any single story...
But it's still a smear.
It is once it takes on the life when it's rooted in annihilation of the target, when there's a political or financial motive at its heart that's not always disclosed, and when it takes on the amplification, as you say, sometimes naturally occurring, but when it sucks up so much space to the exclusion of so much other, you know, news that's out there, I think, yes, that smacks of a narrative or a campaign.
Could I not say the same thing about the Benghazi reporting? I mean... You reported on Benghazi over and over and over again. I happen to think Benghazi was a serious issue that needed a lot of reporting.
But so then, no.
What's that? No, but I could say, I could sit here and say, you know, you narrativized Benghazi, right?
I guess you could say anything. People did say that, and I think that right. was part what of was, also.
What's different between Benghazi and the over? I mean, it's all subjective at some point,
it
right?
It is. It's
right.
very subjective.
So you
the difference.
Say that
I would say, I would say the difference with Benghazi is there was no political or financial motive that was rooted in the annihilation of a target. In fact, with Benghazi,
President Obama.
I certainly wasn't. I didn't even know it went up to President Obama. In fact, my sources on that story were lifelong Democrats, primarily working under the Obama administration. So, if those had been political sources who had been giving me information right. on the other side of the, you know, scale, and that had been coming to me with it, you look long and hard at their motivations, of course, and you report what you need to report. in this case, these people weren't looking to destroy the president. These were people who supported the president in a lot of instances and supported Hillary Clinton. So that differentiates it, in my view, when, you know, the motivations of those making the claims or accusations or who are sources are taken into account.
Given the book, The Smear, and given that, as you say, you were writing it throughout the 2016 presidential campaign, I sort of figured that you would take a look at Donald Trump's own smears, you know, the false accusations that he has leveled at any number of people, most recently Mika Brzezinski, and on and on and on. But you say that Trump is the anti-smear candidate. He was the anti-smear candidate.
Yes, that's, as I describe in the book, that doesn't mean he doesn't smear. And by the way, the Mika Brzezinski thing happened after this was published.
Oh, I know. I wasn't holding you responsible for
it. Anti-smear.
But you also liken him to an action figure, the wild card, a Marvel.
The unexpected. The unexpected comes from Donald Trump. This is what threw everybody off, in my view. But anti-smear candidate doesn't mean he doesn't smear. Quite the contrary. It means he doesn't, the smears don't stick to him the same way they stick to everybody else. And I think that's what the campaign in 2016 proved, that regardless of true smears, as you say, that were promulgated against him, untrue smears were also promulgated against him. He was a child rapist. You know, there were things like that that circulated. But the stuff.
But they didn't circulate very much, right? And the circulation was such that it was debunking, right?
No, there's mainstream media that reported on a child rape case. I
saw your list on that.
Yeah.
And I went back and I looked, and in most cases, you know, I think you can discuss the ethics whether you even write a story about it. But in most cases, they talked about the accuser and the accusations as being somewhat groundless. Am I wrong about that?
I saw some that just took it on as if it's just a news story, just took it on as a straight news story. Ultimately, it was fairly debunked, especially I think there was a news conference called and someone didn't show up. And
right.
There was more of that tone was taken after that. But point being, smears were promulgated against Hillary Clinton. Smears were promulgated against Bernie Sanders, against Donald Trump. They did not stick to Trump, I don't think, in the same way that they stick to other candidates because of he is the wild card because he didn't respond and react to them the way political interests normally do. And that's kind of what made him the wild card and what I think helped, you know, propel him into the election.
But isn't he the antithesis of what you're addressing in this book, namely that he is a promoter of actual smears, like dictionary qualifying smears? And he doesn't have an apparatus. Like, there's no there's no sets of groups behind his smears.
Well, groups joined him later in the, I think, later in the campaign. He didn't have even a super PAC for those early months. Even Republicans didn't support him. And normally, as you know, the super PACs would be doing the opposition research that would be generating the smears, not in the name of the candidate per se, but sort of on behalf of them without their explicit approval. He didn't have that. So as I say in the book, he was his own smear promulgator. It came from his own mouth. It came from his tweets. He was a master brander. He called, you know, gave nicknames to all of his opponents. He did the dirty work himself, you know, in those early months.
Right. You do say that. You say Trump is hit with smear after smear, some of them based on truth and some not. Again, you know, that's not in accordance with our language, but I understand. Then you say, Trump, the successful businessman, combats his political opponents with a stroke of genius. He employs classic brand strategy to tarnish them with catchy nicknames. Lion Ted, Little Marco, Crazy Bernie, Low Energy Jeb. He managed to pick them off one by one until it's just down to him and Crooked Hillary. Donald Trump may be kryptonite to the smear. Now, after reading your various denunciations, or call them that. I read them as denunciations. Of various smears. Here, Donald Trump is calling Ted Cruz a liar inside a nickname, and you're cheering him on.
That's you can take it that way if you want, but that's not cheering him on.
Stroke of genius? Trump, the successful businessman, combats his political opponents with a stroke of genius. He employs classic brand strategies to punish them with catchy nicknames. I mean, if you're saying it's a stroke of genius, that sounds like a plus to me. It's not to you?
Not necessarily. I mean, there are all kinds of ingenious things that can happen that doesn't mean that you agree with what they've done or that you think that what they've done is a good thing. There are all kinds of ingenious things that happen. So, you know, I see how you're reading the book, and I'm glad if that's your takeaway. That's fine. I think other people will have their own.
But aren't those smears in themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I said. He does his own dirty work, I think, were the terms that I used, because he didn't have a super PAC acting on his behalf early on. And then he finally did have one join him after he received the Republican nomination. Mm-hmm. He finally had somebody working on his behalf.
Okay. I get it. So you're just pointing out that he is a different brand of actor and a different approach to these smears. But at the same time, when you talk about the McCain thing, so this is, I guess, July 2015.
2015, right. Very early in the race.
So he talks about John McCain and the whole thing with McCain being a war hero, and it's some very tortured language in the video if you watch it, and I know that you watch it very closely. Your response in the book is not to is wholly different from how you treat the Imus and the Beck episodes, where you talk about the person who has been at the end of a so-called smear. So you don't stick up for McCain. You hammer the Washington Post, who you feel has not properly reported on this incident, as opposed to saying, "Hey, Donald Trump, why are you smearing John McCain?"
Well, number one, no offense to you, just that it was the Washington Post that I wrote about.
No, you're right.
But number two, I'm not here to cheer on or defend John McCain or Donald Trump. I think the media behavior, and people do mistake when you criticize media behavior, or when I do criticize mm-hmm. media behavior at times for how it treats Donald Trump, certainly doesn't mean I support him or in cheering him on. I can see those as separate things, but it is misread often as, you must be supporting him or you must not like X or Y because you've said this. And it has nothing to do with that. It's looking at what I see as fair or accurate media coverage about the candidate. And I have spoken out pretty frequently about that, including some of the Washington Post coverage.
That's fine. No, that's fine.
In fact, let's read this little segment about you.
Okay, that's fine.
Would you like to answer this part?
I'm happy to have the tables turned. Which one is this?
This is the one about, in my transactional journalism chapter, and there was a release of emails between journalists and Clinton aide Philippe Rhines, mm-hmm. and you wrote an article criticizing the swarmy press dealings exposed in the emails, saying corrupt journalism doesn't mm-hmm. pay, nor does abetting it. And then I say, you're about to become embroiled in the very controversy you criticize. Clinton aide Rhines fires back at you in a letter that he wrote you, making it clear that he thinks you've engaged in some of the same transactional journalism. In fact, when it comes to me, which I found surprising, he says that you admitted that you had asked Philippe Rhines, Hillary Clinton's aide, for a, quote, wide-ranging discussion about then-CBS News correspondent Cheryl Akison, and that you asked what the ground rules would be for the talk, and you said, you stipulate, in other words, Rhines could call the shots on the discussion about me. Why were you having a discussion about me with Rhines where he was going to call the shots?
It's called reporting, right?
I don't let people call the shots as terms of my reporting when I do it.
I think that there's something. Let me just check one thing I just want to emphasize here. Is that 163, 164?
It is page 163, yes.
Okay.
But what were you trying to find out about? Why are you calling clearly don't like me to try to get a wide-ranging conversation in which they can dictate the terms about me?
So am I...
No, I'm just asking, what was the topic?
Right. Here's the question. The topic was your work.
Why were you reporting on my work?
Because I'm a media reporter, and you're at CBS News, and you're highly controversial. What else would I do? This is what I'm paid to do.
So you let them stipulate the terms of conversations and enemies.
I don't believe
you approach enemies, and then you let them stipulate terms of conversations.
I don't believe we ever had the conversation, but
I can only tell you what you wrote in your blog and what Philippe Rhines said about you.
It was very clear. I was reading all your work. basically. I was going back and looking at all the transcripts of your work.
And what about Philippe Rhines, who I'd never met, by the way? Do you think, light could he shed on
well,
me?
Well, he was familiar with how you had reported on the State Department and so on and so forth. This is called reporting.
I never met Philippe Rhines, so I don't know what light he could shed.
Had this discussion, and he never did. Okay, so I mean,
it's just interesting that you pointed that you approached him for a wide-ranging discussion where he could stipulate the terms. I think.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. Now, while we're comparing notes on how you come after me in the book, which is perfectly fine, I don't have any problem with that. I am fair game. But I would like to just since we're engaging in this discussion,
cite the page number.
282.
Okay.
So, this is, let me give the introduction on this one.
Okay.
New York Times, you're not happy with Glenn Thrush because the WikiLeaks emails show that at one point he sent a draft of a story to John Podesta seeking a fact check.
I could care less about Glenn Thrush. I never even heard of him before all this. But yes, I'm quoting, based on the WikiLeaks emails, him calling himself a political hack.
Right. He called him political hack. And so he then but that was when he was at Politico. Then he gets hired by the New York Times, right? And when he gets hired by the New York Times, I write it up, and you say, the Washington Post, Eric Wemple, Politico's hottest gold, Huffington Post, Michael Calderon, writes stories about the promotions of Thruss and Haberman, omitting any mention of the recent controversy surrounding them. And I'd just like you to read this passage from my blog post of December 2016, Glenn Thrush on leaving Politico for the New York Times. You can't be an eighth-year senior in high school. Emailing habits may also undergo curtailment. As part of the WikiLeaks dump of emails pertaining to the Clinton campaign chairman, John Podesta, Thrush was put face-to-face with an email he'd sent to Podesta. He was seeking to check his reporting. After sustaining criticism that the email amounted to pre-clearing his draft of the Clinton campaign, Thrush tweeted, nobody controls my stories but me, troll on. I asked him about the situation. I'm paraphrasing that. Asked about the situation, Thrush said, various publications have various policies, and I will adhere by the policies of my publication. Then I write, Politico's policy is to, quote, not share editorial content pre-publication except as approved by editors. So where you said I didn't discuss the controversies,
You did in this article, in the article that I was referring to, and I can send you the site later if you like, as well as the other ones
you
I cited.
You said articles on Thrush and Haberman. There's an article on Thrush and Haberman that discusses.
So you found one that did, and the others that you didn't, you're saying, you know,
no, you
don't
said
matter.
In articles on the promotion, I didn't discuss the controversy, and there it is.
There is an article on the promotion in which you didn't mention the controversy.
Which one?
I'll find it for you and send it to you. Are you saying now that there was no article in which you discussed the promotion and didn't mention the controversy?
I don't remember.
Okay,
it.
Okay, well, I'll send you the site after we get done
well,
off the
this,
air.
But do you have any?
You did once. That's very good, Eric. In one article, it looks like you did, but at least one you didn't. So
okay, well,
if someone reads all your work, they would, if they read all of it,
maybe if you
they
would
get a version,
maybe
you
if
know,
you would email or phone call, I could have addressed the issue,
maybe
right?
Maybe if you would have emailed me instead of calling Philippe Rhines for a wide-ranging conversation about me.
Probably,
then I would talk to you as well.
Probably 40 or 50 unreturned emails and phone calls that I sent to you.
After you reported things about me that were, I think, mischaracterized or showed that you had a bias
against me, I never heard one complaint from you.
Then, well, I'm not going to engage you.
You're not going
to
engage.
Disengage.
So I'm here with
you now.
Right?
But,
no, that's very nice. I just want to go back. I just want to put on the record that I emailed you many, many times to the point that you probably got tired of it.
After you had published things that I thought were disingenuous not true. So I didn't want to engage with you, quite frankly.
Okay. Can you name any of those things that were disingenuous or untrue?
I mean, there were implications.
You're accusing me of a smear, real smear.
I can send you, I don't really want to have an email dialogue with you after this, but I can send you more detail in an email. I don't really want to debate them here while we're talking about the book.
Okay, well, if you're going to say on air that I did something untrue,
would
be good.
You, by your own admission, can't say you didn't publish an article that I've cited where you didn't disclose that Glenn Thrush you know, was involved in a controversy.
You said that I didn't discuss these things.
I didn't say I looked at all your work and that you never mentioned. I said there were articles in which you wrote about the promotion.
You said the articles about the promotions that didn't discuss the controversy.
Yes.
I wrote a story about
You did write a story saying it. Good for you. But you wrote at least one in which you didn't say it.
Don't you think that's an important thing to mention there while you're slamming the media? Don't you think that's important? Eric Wemple did mention it.
No, if there was an article that you had written that didn't discuss it, that many people read who probably never saw this one, then I think that still stands.
That is the article I wrote on Glenn Thrush promotion. But anyway, okay. Let's get back to the book. Where do you go from here? Do you see the smear industry slowing down at all in the coming years? Or do you think that, you know, you talk a little bit about Citizens United. Will the money always be there for it?
Well, as the way things stand now, yes. I mean, I also think, as we trace in the book, it's been decades in the making. It's very hard to disentangle from that quickly. You know, people say, what's the solution? I don't think there is an easy overnight solution. I think we in the news business have allowed ourselves inadvertently in many cases to be used as tools of the industry. I think that it's been happening over a course of years from a very well-funded, well-organized industry in part, and I don't think there's a simple way to make the pendulum swing in the other direction, at least quickly. So I think what the book is about is trying to get people to be aware of it and ask questions. When you see a common narrative pervasive on the news over and over again, out of the thousands of stories we could be talking about on a given night, but we're talking about the same ones over and over, using similar language, and it's also being amplified on social media, doesn't mean it's not true. Doesn't mean there's not a grain of truth there. Sometimes there is, but you should be asking, who wants me to think this, and what is it maybe they don't want me to be looking at? You know, why are they trying to divert my attention in one direction? And I think those are important ways people can kind of at least be thinking about, is someone trying to sway their opinion.
What about, you know, this distinction between narrative and just a story? Is there any way, you know, you said that the Access Hollywood became a narrative, it wasn't just a story. How does the average news consumer make a distinction there?
I think it's really hard. You know, and again, as I say in the book, a smear is in the eyes of the beholder. One person's smear may be another person's truth.
I disagree with that, but okay.
That's all right. This is my book, and I say it up front. But also, I think that, you know, when people watch, some people may think something's a narrative and others may think it's a legitimate story. These are subjective things. I've given, as I say at the top of the book, these are my opinions and kind of how I see what I've seen in the industry. You may disagree, and people may read may disagree, and or may disagree on some points and not others. You may look at one case and say, I think that falls into the category, but this doesn't. And I just hope it gets people thinking, and you're free, and I hope you do form your own judgments. You know, when you read, I'm not trying to wrestle you to the ground and make you think a certain way, just trying to put some facts before you that I think aren't heard a lot of. I mean, you raised a lot of facts that I think are true, that are widely more well-reported. I'm trying to peel back the layers on things that I just don't see and hear written about quite as often.
Very well. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
All right, Eric.
Okay.